welcome to Observations for Our Time. My pleasure to be with you. We've got Scott and Kirk both with us today. How are you fellas?
Just great, thank you.
I'm doing fantastic.
You know, I just noticed a news item that was reported. Dateline is New York. It's being conveyed by Reuters. This is this is amazing. The Defense Department's Inspector General in a June report said that the Army, that would be the U.S. Army, made a $2.8 trillion wrongful adjustments to accounting entries in one quarter alone in 2015, and $6.5 trillion for the year. Yet the Army lacked receipts and invoices to support those numbers or simply made them up. Now, we're not talking about, if you, Scott, were to file your income tax and misrepresent your earnings by $1,000, you are going to be fined. And if you don't pay your fine, they're going to send your sorry behind off to jail. And if
that feels like robbery, by the way.
Yeah, that would be if you misrepresent your earnings, you know, as much as $1,000, you're in serious trouble. And you're going to be lambasted and harassed and fined and possibly even receive a criminal charge, which will send you off to jail. The U.S. Army, that institution that America is somehow convinced is providing its freedom. That one that's providing your safety by making a mess of the world, that institution is the very one that we salute and thank for their service and put our hands over their hearts and sing the national anthem to. Well, I don't, but other people do. They recorded $6.5 trillion of fraudulent spending in the past 12 months. $6.5 trillion.
in the last year.
How can you make a $6.5 trillion error? I mean, the U.S. national debt now is about $20 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And the Defense Department publicly, their public budget, acknowledged budget is about $650 billion a year. And they're, we don't really know how large the clandestine budget is, but it's estimated at about $250 billion a year. So that takes you to just shy of $1 trillion. How do you make a $6.5 trillion error in a year on a $1 trillion budget?
That reminds me of something that happened here in Minnesota. We were told for a long time that we were going to have like a $300 million deficit, right?
Uh-huh.
After the tax season went through, all of a sudden we had $1 billion surplus.
Oh.
And I was just like, I remember asking my dad, I was like, how does that happen? Like, how can they be so dysfunctional? And I was like 14 years old at the time. I was like, how can you be so dysfunctional that you didn't know how much money you had?
Here, this says here, the report affirms a 2013 Reuters series regarding how the Defense Department falsified accounting on a large scale as it scrambled to close its books. I reported this in Shattering Mess. You may recall, Scott, that I said that the U.S. Department of Defense has no accounting system.
Mm-hmm.
They've spent now billions of dollars trying to establish an accounting system. They don't have one. And so what they do at the end of the year, they just take what they think they spent, and they say this is therefore the amount of our budget, and this is our balance sheet, and we don't have the invoices for it, mind you, we don't have any financial backup for it, we haven't a clue as to how many of anything we actually own. We don't know where those things are. We don't know how much we paid for them. We don't know how much of the inventory that we have on our books is for things that we discontinued and took out of service decades ago. We don't have a clue. We haven't a clue onto any of that. We don't even know how much we have committed to buy that has to be funded in the future. But here, we're going to close our books, and we're going to assume that we spent what we were given.
Do you? The thing that's really frustrating about that, is that the government, that's our money. That's
right.
Taken from the people that pay taxes.
Yeah. Can you tell me how being $6.5 trillion off and having no records as to where it was spent, how it was spent, who it went to, how that is a benefit for the United States taxpayer? How we're getting some benefit? Why we should be paying salaries to and saluting and honoring an organization that somehow laundered $6.5 trillion. You know, they used to say a billion there and a billion here, a billion there. So pretty soon, but now we're talking about trillions.
Yeah, I was going to say a billion. You might be able to, oh, whatever. I mean, they spend even that's crazy.
Okay,
but,
yeah.
But $6.5 trillion.
Who writes the check?
Yeah, we do.
How do they spend it? There's got to be a record of spending it somewhere, even if you don't have a receipt for what you bought. Somebody had to write a check, right?
I
transfer money some way.
Well, there's got to be somebody
to answer
for.
They don't have that much cash because there ain't that much cash in the world.
You know what? First of all, I'm dumbfounded that America as a whole can't figure out. We made a bad situation and worse in Vietnam. You know, we went in a bunch of lies. We made a bad situation worse. We lost 50 to 60,000 Americans actually in a counterproductive way. And we really should learn from that and never do that again. And so, you would have hoped that but then the invasion of Afghanistan was exactly the same thing. We made a bad situation worse. We sacrificed a lot of lives, a lot of money, and we're still there making a bad situation worse. Yeah, it was a bad situation there. But it was a situation that we created because we created the Taliban back during the Carter administration to go after the Russians, and it backfired and it created a miserable place for these people to live. But we made it worse. That's why the second most, the highest number of refugees flooding into Europe are from Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And we've made the situation worse for women there, and that's hard to do, considering the way they were mistreated. And then we didn't learn a thing from there, so we invaded Iraq. And oh my God, did we make that country worse? It's inconceivable that America couldn't recognize how counterproductive our invasion of Iraq was. And then we didn't learn from that. So what did we do? We bombed Libya out of existence. In exactly the same scenario. And there's no one in their right mind that would view what we did in Libya as sane. And now we're doing the same thing to Syria? For the same reason? And no one has put up their arm and said, wait a minute, please don't do that in my name. And the same organization that is responsible for all of that just announced that, oh, by the way, we made a $6.5 trillion accounting error. We don't have any invoices or anything to back up any of it. We don't know where the money went.
Well, it happens, right? we really suffer from the old saying, if all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail.
Yeah.
Well, for us, if all you have is a military, then everything must be a war, right?
It must be a war. Must be a war. And we know, and so what we do is we continue to manufacture enemies. It wasn't enough for us to have the Russians as an enemy, so we manufactured an enemy by renting the Taliban from Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then that wasn't enough, so we decided to invade Iraq, and that created the Islamic State. Well, that gave us the opportunity to bomb Syria. Well, that wasn't enough to justify this massive military because, of course, you're using this very sophisticated military to go after sheep herders and camel herders and guys that are intense so that every bomb you drop costs you 1,000 times what you take out. So what we did is we started arming the people we were bombing in Syria with real weapons. So we were supplying their weapons, and then we were bombing those weapons that we created, that we offered them. And that wasn't even enough, so we decided, why don't we create a scenario in the Ukraine where we create a riot that destroys that government that the Russians and the Ukraine won't go along with, so there'll be a breach, and then we'll say that the Russians are trying to reestablish the Cold War, and we'll give justification for NATO. Then we could have the Russians as an enemy again. We need a real military to confront them. And then why don't we start antagonizing the Chinese? Why don't we position our military so that that our guns are pointed towards them? Why don't we challenge their defense zone? even though it's smaller than our defense zone. Because you need a real military to go after the Chinese, right?
You know, there was a military guy, a former high-ranking official in the government, uh-huh. who's retired now, on the radio the other day, and he uh-huh. said exactly what you've said over and over and over again about Russia and China and all.
Uh-huh.
And he says, you know, we can't, right now, there's no way we could invade Russia. We would
no.
be worse off than Napoleon.
They'd right.
wipe us out.
So they'd wipe us out.
We couldn't even land in China.
Right.
You know, they don't even have to send guns. They can send gas with sticks like they did.
Oh, invading China would be like this myth that there was a revolution in Turkey.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, all you have to do is count that the country has become a fundamentalist Islamic dictatorship, and so all you had to do is to have somebody say, okay, you Muslims, these guys that are taking over your country, they're secularists, stand out in the street and oppose them, and the you know, it was over before it got started. Now you imagine the United States invading China?
Yeah. What could you do with China?
Oh, my God. You mean there is no scenario where we could project a force and invade China, and there's no reason for China to invade the United States. We're yeah. their primary market, and they own us.
Well, the what he said is we chose the – there was a doctrine that came up at the fall of mm-hmm. the Russian Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
and he said in that we basically told ourselves – that we have unilateral use of anything we want for, you know, talk about ego. Unilateral decisions to make whatever we want to make, it doesn't matter. We don't care what the Chinese do. We don't care what the Russians do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the actual doctrine that they follow for foreign policy.
Yeah.
We know from WikiLeaks what we did in the Middle East.
Right.
It's like...
from WikiLeaks we know that we actually deliberately and knowingly planned the war that's taking place in Syria now. We instigated it. We armed both sides for the specific purpose of witnessing the carnage we're witnessing. And then we go off and say, well, you know, it's our patriotic duty to go on fight these
and
bastards.
It's your patriotic duty to pay taxes to pay off the debt that they borrowed. Because they didn't use any real money. That's a debt.
Of course.
Just to, yeah. We're going to pay it off.
Right. And the world won't loan us any money. The world won't loan us any money anymore, so we do quantitative easing to create the illusion of funding our debt.
Yeah.
And by the way, you don't have a candidate running for a public office that wants to even deal with it. They don't even mention the debt anymore.
No.
So,
economy so strong that they would make, that's the pitch, that you would have so much money left over you could pay off the debt. You can't get out of this hole.
No, you can't get out. No,
get out of
no. It was possible 20 years ago when I started writing about it that you'd sell the federal land that was, you know, essentially to become a state. If you were a Western state, you had to cede the between 40 and, depending on the state, like Alaska, up to 80% of your land. You had to give it to the federal government for the right to become a state. And, oh, by the way, the Constitution allows for a new state to voluntarily come into the Union, although we have some, like Hawaii, that were just confiscated. There is no procedure for leaving the Union. So how could you have freedom and you have no procedure whatsoever? Yeah, to withdraw from the Union.
Yeah.
But the whole thing is just if it wasn't so deadly, it would be laughable.
Well, you know that laugh you have or I have when everything is so dire, you just have to go.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they call it the gallows laugh.
Yeah,
that's kind of where we are.
My laugh.
All right, we have been all over the board here, and it's been a long time since we were back in Yeshaya, Isaiah. We've covered the first three statements really quite well. The first in Yeshaya 1 is Yeshaya just saying, here's who I am. Here's who I am in the sense of this is, is the timing in terms of here's the kings of Yehuda during the breadth of my revelation. And then the first statement is not from Yeshaya, it's from Yahweh. And Yahweh makes what I consider to be one of the most profound, one of the most important, one of the most insightful statements in the whole of the Torah and prophets. And he says that you were my children. I raised you. I elevated your status. I nurtured you. I cared for you. I helped you grow. And you rejected me. That means that God's view is that man exists for the purpose of the covenant. And, you know, I wrote something just about a half an hour ago. And I was dealing with Abram at the time. He became Abraham, but Abram at the time, beginning the 15th chapter of Bereshit. And you probably heard me say this a number of times, guys, but Abram turns to Yahweh and says, you know, I don't get it. What are you giving me? I don't have a child. I don't get it. What are you giving me? How am I going to inherit something if I don't even have a child? And what I came to is something really quite profound. It's not just that Abraham didn't understand the symbolism that was being offered to him. For example, the land has nothing to do with Israel and everything to do with Israel in the sense that the land represents Yahweh's home. And so I'm giving you this forever. Well, the earth isn't going to exist forever. So what he's saying is, I'm giving you this land as my realm where we're going to live together forever. Represents heaven. So the bottom line here is that the covenant did not exist for the purpose of Abram and Sarai having a child, later Abraham and Sarah. It wasn't their family. The covenant is not the family of Abraham. Jehovah's family.
Jehovah's family, yes.
Yeah. So Abraham, he missed the entire purpose. It wasn't for him to have a kid and for that kid to have an inheritance that Abraham was passing on to him. Yahweh was childless.
Totally different perspective, isn't it?
It was for Yahweh to have a kid. Abraham may have been 90, but Yahweh was offering to adopt he and his wife and then to give them his inheritance. The perspective is literally the inverse of what Abraham was viewing. Now, it would be shortly thereafter that Abraham and Sarah would have Yishak. But not because Yishak was the, and I think I've written this in the past, that Yishak was the first child of the covenant. That's not true. Abraham was the first child of the covenant. Yes, Sarah was the second child of the covenant, and Yishak was the third. But by having Yishak, they modeled the nature of the covenant. That way that Yahweh and Abraham got to enjoy being a father at the same time. Give them something to relate to and to share in common. The joys of being a parent. But he completely missed it. The covenant isn't man's family. It's God's family. So anyway, that sets the tone. So the entire book of Yashaya, I would say, quite simply, the entire Torah, everything God has to say, can be encapsulated in, as your father, I sought to raise you as my children. And I nurtured you, I fed you, I uplifted you, I encouraged you, I made you much greater than you would otherwise be. And you rejected me. So there's no religion there. There's no obedience there. There is simply a family relationship, the covenant. Yahweh's father, not Lord. No, certainly not dictator. Saying, that's all that I wanted to do, and I did what I offered, and you rejected it. And what did they reject it for? What did they replace it with?
Religion.
Religion. Family of man. So then that leads to Yahweh making a statement. So, you know, a cow knows her maker. You know, a cow, which is the term for cow, is one who is observant. The one who is observant knows their maker.
Sure.
And he said, even an ass knows its Lord.
Yeah, and one that doesn't pay attention, he knows
its Lord. Yeah, an ass and particularly knows his Lord. But Israel, you are so ignorant, so unaware, so oblivious. Your problem is you don't have a clue. Now, from there, this is what God says. So, woe, and you don't want woe. Woe is a bad thing. Woe to an errant and blameworthy nation acting like Gentiles, severely stubborn and heavily laden, dulled and unresponsive, with corruptions and guilt associated with perverted distortions, the offspring of errant, harmful, and evil children who corrupt and destroy, lacking integrity. They have rejected and abandoned Yahweh. That is the first half of the fourth statement in Yeshayah. Now, what this says is that perverted distortions, corruptions, a dulled and unresponsive attitude, which is the failure to use our neshama, conscience, the way it was intended. So it's there are a lot of things that cause the masses to reject and abandon Yahweh. One of them is to place their faith in things which are errant and blameworthy. The second is to be dulled in terms of one's responsiveness so that you're not processing information. That was the case with this fellow that Larry and James and I were trying to awaken relative to his support of Enoch. Your thought process is dulled and unresponsive. And you're guided by corruptions. Perverted distortions. The book of Enoch, for example, is a corruption and a perverted distortion. And so when you're unresponsive rationally, when you're wallowing in errant and blameworthy ideas, when you become corrupt with perverted destruction, what God is saying that you become the source of errant and evil children, and that they in turn corrupt and destroy. Because they lack integrity.
They follow along and reteach it to their children and on and on and on.
Right. And all that leads to rejecting and abandoning Yahweh. Now, then he goes on to say, beyond that, he says, they have come to despise, and they actually revile, genuinely feeling contempt for, accordingly, the set apart one of Yisrael. Individuals engage, and those are the individuals who engage and endure with God, Israel. They have become strangers, alienating themselves, having gone backwards in the wrong direction. So here's this situation. They're steeped in a milieu of errant and blameworthy Gentile ideas. Their ability to think and to be rational, their neshama, their conscience, is dulled and unresponsive.
Right.
As a result, their entire thought process is corrupt and perverted. Therefore, they give birth to children who are errant and harmful and evil, who then corrupt and destroy because they have been raised in an environment where they lack integrity. They can't tell right from wrong, and that's the environment we live in today. No one can tell right from wrong. And that as a result, they have rejected and abandoned Yahweh. Now, he goes one step further beyond this. And this is the thing that I have said so many times, and I stand by it. I don't think that it's something that is comfortable for people to hear. But, Kirk, I don't think it's just a matter that Christians prefer the caricature that they have created based upon Dionysus of their Jesus Christ, their new and improved God. It's not just that they prefer Jesus to Yahweh, that they prefer their Pauline New Testament to the Old Testament.
Right.
They really hate the God of the Old Testament. None of them would admit that, but that's really the idea, because any time you confront them with the Torah, they despise it.
Yeah, this journey I've been on for almost 8.5 years now, I cannot tell you how much they hate you for even challenging their thought process or their faith.
Right.
They turn on you, man. They just can't stand you.
And even if 100% of what you have to say is simply conveying Yahweh's testimony, they will get angry at, hate, despise God's own testimony. So he's right. It's you know, when the religious Jews claim that, you know, they're doing all of this for Hashem, and they play the religious dress up, and they do their bobbing their heads and their minions with all their rabbinical prayers.
Total BS.
What God is saying is that it's not just that they are misguided. It's not just that they're irrational. It's not just that they lack integrity. He says they really hate me. And that's why they won't say my name. That's why they replaced my Torah with their Talmud. That's why they decided that they're going to bob their heads up and down in prayer when I've never asked them to pray. Not even listening to it. They hate me.
Yep. I read the covenant today.
Yeah.
Praise, you know, I can't find the prayer and the praise and the worship anywhere.
Oh, you read the 8 or 9 chapters of Bereshit that deal with the covenant?
Yeah, it's just
if you know that the chapters 9 and 10 of Observations for Our Time, which we're now talking about chapter 6, we've got a ways to go to get there.
Yeah.
But chapters 9 and 10 turned out unexpectedly to be a complete representation, if you will, of the terms and conditions of the covenant. And it became that because Yahweh's provisions for life at the beginning of Yeshayah 3:1 were being withdrawn. And so if Yahweh is going to withdraw his provisions for life, it's rather important to let people know how to get them back.
Yes.
Now, I made I phrased this inaccurately, and Roy corrected me, and to the degree that I still have a legacy of this, I want to make sure that I correct myself. When Yahweh wrote in Yeshayah 3:1 that he was withdrawing his provisions for life, he's not changing anything that he has promised us or changing any of the promised benefits of the covenant. If you have accepted the terms and conditions of the covenant, his provisions for life are yours. And it's because Yahweh can't withdraw anything that he has committed to do. By withdrawing his provisions for life from Yahudah, what he's saying is that up to that point, he had done everything he could to draw their attention to his plan. He had sent prophet after prophet. He had communicated with Moshe, with Shamuel, with Dode, with Hezekiah, and then prophet after prophet after prophet.
Sure.
He had done everything he possibly could in Yahudah to draw their attention to this, and he had even protected them from the attack of the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have been wiped out. There would have been no Jerusalem had the Assyrians had their way. And so he had worked very hard to do this very thing. And all he's saying is, you know, I'm not going out of the way, my way, to offer this to you anymore. It's there in the Torah. Read it. Take advantage of it if you want to. But actively offering it and engaging, that's not something I'm going to do for you. And, you know, what I think happened is if you look at Yahudah after that time, of course, they were just taken up and hauled into slavery by Babylon. And then ultimately they were captured by the Greeks and then harassed by the Romans and then harassed by the Byzantines and then harassed by the Muslims. And it just goes on and on. On and on. And the only people that really went out of his way to help were just individuals. It was not the nation, was not something he reached out to anymore.
Yeah.
Now it's strictly individuals. So we'll return in a moment.